This is a recording of an interview with a nephew of J.B. Weatherspoon, and also an interview with Herbert Peacock, who taught on the faculty at Southern with Weatherspoon and is married to a relative of Weatherspoon. They were recorded by Roy Jones in June of 1973.
You always want to have to understand that I kind of like to take a little fun for it and very serious. And then I get serious, but I'm going to do a little music. Will you let me do this? It's not religious because you can't claim anything religious on this instrument. But it is fascinating.
But was there an areas of disagreement or contrast that you might want to share with me?
Yes, as far as I know, the relationship remained a very warm personal relationship. When I first came to the seminary, Santa was still president, and he was, of course, the old war horse that he'd always been, and at times spoke in very, very harsh terms, both in chapel. I've heard him speak in chapel as if he were ready to go to war the next day, you know, declare war, this is the thing to do. But also in his Hebrew classes, would indicate his attitudes toward war. On the other hand, Weatherspoon, in his quiet way, I never heard him speak in chapel in these terms, but in his quiet way in classes and in personal conversation, would indicate his position in opposition to this war horse attitude. And this was when I was a student and didn't know him so very well. But in later years, also, the relationship with Santa seemed to have been a very warm personal one. He indicated disagreement, particularly at this point, but indicated also his high regard for Santa and the fact that the relationship, even in spite of disagreements about the issues, relationship remained firm and strong all the way through. This is certainly my memory of talking with Weatherspoon.
If I could clarify, if you're able to, Dr. Sampi's position, as best I understand it, was one of great militancy, which particularly in the 41 before Pearl Harbor, was one of we've got to go to war. And are you saying that throughout the war that Dr. Weatherspoon opposed war, or that he was not at the extreme militant?
No, I don't. I wouldn't say that he ever opposed war as a possible solution, but he was opposed to the war horse attitude, which said we must fight at all costs, that we must win the battle, that the solution to the problem is going to be send our troops over and get the war over. He was opposed to this. And when, as I recall talking with him about it, spoke much more in terms of another type of solution, an approach to the overall situation, rather than going in to win the battle, to try to solve the issues which underlay the difficulties that were being faced. I've talked with him personally at times. In fact, one of the problems that came up was my going to the chaplaincy. I went to the chaplaincy at this time and talked at great length with Weatherspoon about this. And it became very clear to me in conversation with him that he was a pacifist at heart. And yet, in talking, it became also equally obvious that service as a chaplain to military men was something he could respect very highly. He did not have a hang-up at this place which said no contact with the military. It was simply that he felt that this was not the solution to the problems that the world faced. But, I don't suppose there's any place in which you could pin him down in a classroom situation and say, what is the absolute answer? He didn't tend to do this. He left his impressions of where he was, but he also said, it's your responsibility to make a decision about it. And he was not anti-war in the sense that we must reject at all costs war, and anything is worse than war. He wasn't at this point, very clearly.
This is an interview with Mr. Everett Weatherspoon on June 21st, 1973. Mr. Weatherspoon, your uncle was a man who was concerned about various kinds of social issues, and I wonder if in your relationship with him, particularly as you matured, if there are incidents that where you and he shared concerns about racial matters or about political matters or labor management, economic matters, and if you have some recollections that you would like to share, some impressions of the kind of concern that he had as a Christian.
Well, my recollections are minimal on these matters because during most of the time I was just a very young fellow, and Uncle Jesse came to Durham only occasionally, and I simply saw him as a youngster looking up to one of his father's brothers. He was always a man that we held in the highest regard and esteem, and looked forward to his coming. My contacts with him, my most intimate contacts with him, were on two occasions when I visited in Louisville. One in 1945, as I was returning home after being discharged from the Army following the war, and visited in his home in Louisville for two or three days. I do not have any particular recollections of attitudes on particular subjects that may have been discussed during that time. I only remember the cordial hospitality of his home and his wife, and living there with them for a few days and attending a class at the seminary which he taught, and of meeting the great-grandson of Dr. John A. Broadus, who also attended the class on the day I did. Dr. John A. Broadus had been the author of a book on the preparation and delivery of sermons, which Uncle Jesse had many years later revised. And we thought it quite coincidental that the three of us were present that day. My entering the coincidence was the fact that my middle name was Broadus, having been named for the original author of this book. Later, I visited in Louisville, or I was in Louisville, for the funeral of Aunt Ada, his first wife, and I traveled on the train with him from Louisville to Roy, to Richmond, where we were met by one of his brothers, Herbert Weatherspoon, and drove to Roy. So that those were not occasions on which we got into very much discussion of social matters, attitudes on politics or labor management matters. My most vivid recollection of his political attitudes are those that I simply heard my father discuss. When he pointed out that while the family had always been Democrats in North Carolina, which included Uncle Jesse when he was here, Uncle Jesse had voted Republican in Louisville in Kentucky elections, where it was somewhat similar to North Carolina. respect to the Democratic Party, if you wanted to participate in the naming of office holders, you had to be a Democrat and participate in the primary. Otherwise, your vote, if it were cast for the other side, was lost already, because the Democrats always carried the elections. Now, it was true, apparently, in the local picture in Louisville, that the time he was there, that the Republicans did the same thing. And so he voted Republican in the local elections, and a Democratic, if he felt that way about it, although I'm sure if he didn't feel that way about it, he voted the other way in the national elections.
I've had some other indications that he was more of an independent in his voting than perhaps others that came out of the South. That and Kentucky does have and has had a two-party system that where that you have that option. I grew up in West Tennessee, and, mm-hmm. and if you were not a Democrat, as you say, you simply didn't have a vote except in the November election, and then usually it was thrown away because there was not a serious candidate. So that does make a difference when you have a genuine two-party system. Well, you mentioned being there shortly after the war. In your conversations with your uncle, did you discuss or did he share with you any of his impressions concerning the war or his hopes for the country and Southern Baptists in the light of the peace situation, or any concern about the atomic bomb that had just been dropped, any of these things?
I cannot honestly say that I have any recollections of expressed attitudes on his part on these subjects. I'm sure he had opinions, and I suspect we could reconstruct them.
I'm working real hard on that and have some information.
Just from the very nature of the man, I suspect we could sit here tonight if we wanted to speculate, which we don't, and could perhaps almost reconstruct what his attitudes would have been on some of these subjects that you mentioned. I do not have the impression that he was a pacifist in the sense of being unwilling to have participated or to have condemned those who did. Mm-hmm. Now, I won't say that he wasn't a pacifist. He never told me he wasn't a pacifist, that he was or wasn't a pacifist. Mm-hmm. But I think these things sort of come out when one does have strong feelings in this direction. I don't mean by that either that he endorsed the war necessarily, but I think he was a supporter of the country and would have backed our cause, whatever that might have meant at the time.
What was the family's attitude towards his involvement in the church and convention? And was there ever any concern particularly about some of the stands that he took on racial matters?
If so, I never heard any opposition to it. He, the family was very proud of him and of his stands. He never had to explain his position to any of his brothers or sisters. If he felt that way, he was regarded as being a man quite capable. I would say that he was somewhat more liberal than some other members of his family, but this never created a problem between him and them. I don't recall ever having been any friction in the family over the attitudes of anybody. Pretty much the same way. supported each other.
I think the impression I have gotten from the Weatherspoons that I've encountered is that the family as a whole has been a strong, committed Christian family, that at least the ones that I have met to this point, the traditions have been rather strong within the family, and I think your grandfather had and grandmother had been very strong church
people. Well, that's right. They were committed themselves. I remember very well the in this material that Emily Weatherspoon provided us, a description of the family at prayer. They apparently had daily prayer in the home and daily devotions in the home. She describes, he describes, or whoever the one the originator of the story, my grandfather is kneeling and praying every night after reading from the scriptures. And that whenever he was called on to pray in church, he'd knelt. Which I think is indicative of a rather deep devotion to the church and to the Lord. Yeah. And he, Uncle Jesse, absorbed all of this. He became committed quite young. The other times that I had opportunity to talk with him as an adult were after his retirement, when he had moved to Raleigh. And we saw somewhat more of him then. Even then, though it wasn't like every week, after his health began to fail, I tried to visit him every week, and particularly during the period of his hospitalization. He was hospitalized, I think, at least twice, and I used to go over on Saturday mornings, because I was still working then myself here in Durham, and I used to go over on Saturday mornings and spend time with him. And I'm sorry I didn't keep notes on what was said, but my impressions were that all of the things I had thought about Uncle Jesse during the years of high regard and respect were accentuated by these latter contacts.
And I believe you're a member of Temple Baptist Church, which ordained him, and would your impression be that through the years the church has been supportive of his ministry and affirming him as one of the sons that has come out of the church?
In every way. There's never been a position that he took that found opposition in the church, in our church.
So would you say some of the positions that he has taken then in the larger context of the Southern Baptist Convention directly influence the church here?
Well, I would say that is true. We have had some opportunity in our church to take stands with respect to racial matters, and they were always stands which he would have approved. Sometimes not easily taken.
Thank you. As a pastor, I can appreciate that statement. You've been a deacon for some number of years, I believe,
yes,
in the church.
I've served on the board ever since the death of my father. I was elected to complete his unexpired term when he died in 1933. And I've been on the board for 3 out of every 4 years since then. We have a rotating system, except for the period when I was in the service. During the middle 40s.
And I believe your grandfather also was a deacon in the church here. So
yes,
he was
chairman of the board of deacons. I don't know for how long. I'm not sure that he was chairman at the time of his death, though he may have been. He was chairman. My father was chairman.
I served as chairman. So it's quite a tradition of the Wetherspoons and Temple Baptist Church here in Durham.
My grandfather was a charter member of the church.
Seems like I came across something in the materials that Mrs. Wetherspoon sent up. Some anniversary of the church that Dr. Wetherspoon had been back for to speak. And
I don't remember which one it was. It may have been the 75th. The church was organized in 1888, wasn't it? I think it was 88. Because we had, the 85th birthday this year.
That would have fit in about 10 years ago.
Must have been the 75th.
Which would have been a major celebration, I'm sure, in the life of the church. And do you think of anything else that might help me in putting together an understanding of this man's ethics and his position as a churchman, teacher, pastor, denominational leader from your experience, or what you have heard through your family? Obviously, I can't interview every Wetherspoon that I would like to, but...
Well, my recollections of his preaching, I've heard him preach a number of times over the years, is that his base was quite... I hesitate to use the word fundamental because I don't mean to imply that he was a fundamentalist rather than something else.
Fundamental with a small f.
Yeah, that's right. He dealt with basics. He preached from the Bible. He stuck very close to the Bible in his preaching. And yet he was liberal. I think that the record will show that very clearly. His stands on social matters would indicate that he was a liberal in his theological, at least in his practical thinking, about matters in which morals and ethics and religion should be concerned. And this is not always a combination that you find. Sometimes some very reactionary men in the ministry who also give the impression of being quite fundamental in their preaching with respect to stay close to the scriptures and that sort of thing. So I think this is one thing that is different about him than from some others, and one that gives me even more confidence in his liberal attitude, that he didn't have to stray away from the basic concepts of his religion in order to arrive at these attitudes, which makes me feel that they are right attitudes that we can all pretty much aspire.
From talking with Dr. Carlton, I had the impression that you and he, your uncle, would not have too much difficulty in sharing attitudes, that Dr. Carlton's impression of you was that your attitudes in social and theological matters would be very close to those of your uncle.
Well, I think that's true, and I, while I don't remember Uncle Jesse ever getting me down and saying, boy, here's where you should think. I suspect that he had his influence on the attitudes that I have had.
Several have indicated that he led by his example, and that many times it was not so much what he said, but by the way he acted, that when he did say something, this communicated it as you just testified to. I appreciate that sharing.
I remember at the time of the departure of the 13,
yes, sir.
Uncle Jesse espoused that cause, and I think he didn't just secretly admire them. I think he was outspoken about it, and I heard him discuss this at length on more than one occasion. And Dr. Lewis was one of those men who has been in Raleigh for a number of years. And there was another of those men whose name was Peacock, I believe, who traveled, made that trip from Louisville to Richmond on the train when we were bringing Aunt Ada back to Raleigh. I knew at least those two. I think perhaps I have known some others whom I don't recall at the moment. But he was very supportive of them, and I think they looked to him for counsel on occasion. Throughout the whole incident and even after. But there was never any rancor, in his attitudes about this. While he thought that certain people were wrong in the positions they had taken, he continued to be friends with and to associate. It didn't disrupt the relationship any more than one's having a different opinion would naturally affect the relationship.
In my study of him, I see this incident as a major test of his ethical concerns. Would you say that he was able to separate issues and personalities?
Yes, I would.
And in the times that you heard him share, it was issues rather than just so-and-so is wrong because he is so-and-so.
Yes, I say that's true, although I wouldn't say that he did not feel strongly that certain persons took positions that he would have himself found difficult to justify.
But the central thrust was from a basis of an ethical concern about the issues that were involved.
And I think that he felt that the attitudes of the 13 were, by and large, the attitudes which he was able to support.
Now, let me ask you this. In listening to him share, was he able to see the bad that was on the side of the 13 in any situation, the full life you've had, there's good and bad in any issue, and it's usually on both sides. Was he able to see any, if not wrong, at least lack of wisdom, lack of...
I would say the answer to that is yes. As I recall, that there were some of those who had taken issue with the administration at Louisville that had not been particularly politic in their expression of positions.
And perhaps it lost the perspective of issue rather than personalities.
May very well have.
1973 concerning Dr. J.B. Weatherspoon. Dr. McCall, this is a list of the men on the executive committee in 1945 and in 1946. There was a very significant change that was made from the Social Service Commission as a committee of the convention to the establishment of an executive secretary. I believe this came about in the period under discussion from about 1945 until it became a reality in 1947. And one of the things in my research that I've come across is the contrast between the efforts of Dr. Poteet back in 1933, 34, and 35 to establish an office of the Social Service Commission with a man who would serve as a researcher, which is very similar to what Dr. Weatherspoon sought to establish at this time. And yet they seem to have gone about it in a slightly different manner, in that Dr. Poteet seemed to have gone directly to the convention. My impression is that Dr. Weatherspoon went to the executive committee and worked through friends on that committee. Are there men that you recognize on that committee that would be very favorable towards such an establishment of the commission, or are you familiar with how this became a reality?
I don't really have any immediate memory with reference to it. I see the name of Henry W. Tiffany from Virginia here. Henry Tiffany would have been open to this sort of thing. I'm looking for other names. John Buchanan would have been strongly in favor of this. J.M. Dawson of Texas, who was very influential in the executive committee at that time, would have been strongly in favor. R.C. Campbell would have been open. Howard Williams of Oklahoma would have been open. Height Moore open. Miss Blanche White of Virginia would have been highly favorable. Now, that's just not really remembering that what they said, but remembering the style of their operation. I think, however, that in 1945, you have to remember that this is the close of World War II. The whole Dachau kind of atrocities and so on are now coming out and really hitting the public. It isn't that you didn't have talk during World War II of war crimes, but the close of the war really began to have pictures and the newsreel type of picture in the movies and so on, showing the what the troops found in these concentration camps. And the whole atmosphere of the country suddenly is in revulsion against Nazi atrocities. This then had a sort of second wave that you began to be concerned about how are we dealing with the social issues in our own country, and it made the, in my judgment, made people more open towards research into social issues. Though, and I may be going further than you need at this point, though there was a strong tendency to define social issues as sexual morality, temperance, and so on, rather than to think in terms of civil, what we've come to call civil rights. But there was a mood in the land, and the executive committee would have had strong leadership like Dawson and Buchanan, who would be quite articulate and quite politically knowledgeable within the executive committee about how to guide a project like this through. Then Dr. Weatherspoon would have been a close friend of a great many of these people. And I can't really prove that. But
former students of his.
Yes, and so on. So I think that that may explain. Then I'm reaching for something else. The bells are ringing in the back of my head. Was not Weatherspoon for a while on the executive committee?
back in 1928 and 29.
And not after that?
Not after that, no. He was on the Social Service Committee in 30 when he came to the seminary here. He had served on the Educational Commission and had served on a committee concerning Negro education, which had permitted him to get to know a number of these people, and as well as through his work with students. So.
I have some sort of lingering memory that he made some point in dealing with the executive committee at this period about as a former member of the executive committee, which of course we're so far from 28 now that that sounds like ancient history. But in 45, well, that's more like 15 years, and there would be people who would remember. Further, you did not have then the rotation of the executive committee that you now have. Therefore, it's entirely conceivable that there were members of the executive committee who were on the executive committee when Weatherspoon was on it.
Well, now, a related event to this was the establishment of a special committee on race relations, in which Weatherspoon was named chairman of this committee, and then selected persons from various other groups made up this committee. And it came forward with recommendations which were, in 1947, considered very progressive as compared with anything the Southern Baptist Convention had ever done before.
Was that, it was 47, the convention in Chicago, do you remember?
I know them by the annual, and I haven't paid any attention
to
where the
see,
place is.
I tend to date them by place rather than by year. I recall in the Chicago convention, though this may, no, that would have to be somewhere in the late 40s, but Hugh Brim was also involved by that time.
Now, it could be that that committee made its report in 48, which would have permitted this, because this report was later widely circulated by the Social Service Commission with a foreword by Dr. Weatherspoon.
Yeah, now, well, the 48 statement I recall because I used it in a Baptist Hour message entitled Equal Under God, short, and used that report in 48.
Okay, now I think the committee was appointed in 47 and the report was made in 48.
Yeah, well, that'll clear up. Yes, I recall the report, and as I say, I made personal use of it. I was a Baptist Hour speaker, and I wanted to deal with the subject of race relations on a nationwide hookup, my technique for doing it was to root my message then in this report, which interestingly, if I had done the same thing 7-8 years later, it would have been highly controversial. But in 48, using this and making this statement, I don't really recall any very sharp criticism. And the Baptist Hour at that time, you see, you were dealing with a period before the real advent of television. Therefore, the radio was the medium of mass communication at that moment. And the Baptist Hour was really listened to by all Southern Baptists as well as many others. And therefore, whatever that committee said, is the point I'm making, is that it resonated with the popular mind in such a way that it could be used, and this could be used as a statement of the Southern Baptist Convention and as the Southern Baptist posture, yet pick up a relatively minor amount of controversy. I'm doing this personally, not because the personal element is important, but that's what I can remember.
Well, you're relating something here too that is relative to a question I planned to ask you about, and that is, you then see
some definite significance to the various resolutions that have been presented through the Social Service Committee and the use of them through the convention in the manner which you've just described.
Again, there are two attitudes towards resolutions. One is that if you adopt a resolution, you've done it. Well, obviously you haven't. That is, you haven't changed the world. The other is that resolutions are something to be made fun of. But there is, the truth is in the middle between those two, that once a statement is made by the convention in the form of a resolution, then those who concur with that resolution have an official document they can use. And by using that, then they challenge the conscience of people who disagree and put them really on the defensive. And now you've got to account for why you don't agree with what the convention has said. And this is a very important and powerful factor. But if you use as your test, you know, did all Southern Baptists change their practices because of a resolution? Obviously, resolutions are impotent. But if you see it as more creating a wind that blows in a certain direction, nobody has to walk with the wind. But if the wind keeps blowing long enough, most people will turn their back to the wind and go with it. So resolutions have that kind of force. It is a moral force, and it is a political force. And those two things consistently applied over a period of time are quite influential in Southern Baptist life.
I raise that because I've noticed that there was a significant change in the variety of resolutions when Dr. Weatherspoon replaced Dr. Barton as chairman. And the broader dimensions of social action or social consciousness, probably would be better for Southern Baptist terminology, began to be seen at conventions as these resolutions were made.
Yes, well, again, I have some personal memory of that from another direction. I think if you check, you'll find that John W. McCall of Memphis was on the committee under both Barton and Weatherspoon's chairmanship. And of course, this is my father, and so I used to hear what went on in these committee meetings and so on, and then follow the action taken on them. Because of the family connection, so that I really followed it much more closely than if it had just been another agency. In other words, there are other agencies dealing with other issues that were of, say, equal importance that I really don't carry much memory for or impression of at all. I'd have just to go back and read the record. But I do have a memory of this. I do remember the struggle that was reflected in my father's reporting to refocus the committee on a broader spectrum, a larger set of issues, and more contemporary issues related in social consciousness over against a focus almost exclusively on individual morality.
I gather then your father identified with the group that Weatherspoon would be with.
And, yes, as a matter of fact, he did. And this was part of the thing that was happening was that a Deep South lawyer and a layman, you see, and as his friendship with Weatherspoon was very strong because they were on the same side, and an attorney's advocacy had some skill in it, but in addition, it was a layman's platform, also had clout in dealing with a committee generally dominated by clergymen. So he and Weatherspoon made common cause to try to make this kind of shift in the emphasis of the committee.
Do you remember any of your father's impressions of Weatherspoon? Notice that they had worked together for some 7 or 8 years on the committee, and in different terms.
Not really. In other words, it was issues
rather than personalities.
Right. Well, and whatever came through in personalities is just lost in my memory. In other words, I don't really. I know that they were very close friends. I know that Weatherspoon used to visit in our home in Memphis, and that this was a tie that made him a welcome guest in the pulpit of the First Baptist Church of Memphis. So my father was frequently chairman of the deacons in the church, and therefore when they were looking for pulpit supplies, Dr. Weatherspoon's appeared as pulpit supply more frequently than accident would have accounted for. And this grew out of the fact of his friendship. And then that provided opportunities for conference between them. So I, again, can't pinpoint this, but I have that feeling of my father's saying, well, we'll get Dr. Weatherspoon to preach when the pastor is out. And so on, and then in those days, which of ancient, hallowed and pleasant memory, the visiting preacher always ate dinner in somebody's home, so he always would come to our home for his Sunday noon meal after the service, and then they'd get off in the living room and go to hammering out some of their strategy and commission.
Wouldn't take a little different tack, still going back into your memory. I've gone through your notes and I found something rather interesting in that in the syllabus there is a section on the ethical teachings of Jesus, and you do not have any notes on that. But in the syllabus, there's no mention of communism or Nazism, fascism, and yet you have several lectures on that. Can you remember any reason for this?
No, I don't. I have not, of course, attempted that correlation you've done, but actually, I don't remember any. Well, that's just a data I didn't even know, and I have no memory of it. I'm trying to reach for, somewhere I've had something with Weatherspoon on the ethical teachings of Jesus, but nothing comes through in this, and I'm intrigued that it's not in the notes. So it may have been, again, that may be a comment on the notes, and yet the point you're making is that there are sections in the notes, not in the syllabus. I can't explain.
The reason I ask is, what you have here is the first term of a three-term year course, and as I've read through the catalog, you had the option of taking just one term and then going on. Ordinarily, in his course, the two that you have would have been included in the second term.
Mm-hmm.
And I was concerned whether or not, because of the world situation, this is about 1936 or 37, I looked up when you had the course, but I don't remember which year. But this was a time in which there was a great deal of concern about what was going on in Germany and Italy and in Russia also.
Yeah.
And I wondered if he was trying to get this before more of his students that wouldn't take the second
term. This could be an explanation. I don't even remember that you checked. I don't remember. My memory is that I was in his course for the full year. Is that memory verified by the record? I don't remember.
Your notes do not verify.
Yeah.
Now, the record only shows a completion of classes, and it doesn't state whether or not it's for the full term or for just portions of the year.
Yeah. Well, my memory would not be reliable even at this point because
and I didn't check the records, which the records I checked of the listings in the back of the catalog. catalog, which at that time published the students who were in the various classes. And I haven't checked with the ultimate source that could answer that question.
This is probably irrelevant, except, of course, that's a reflection of the fact that originally the seminary was structured around the idea that there was a school of New Testament studies, a school of Old Testament studies, a school of theological studies, and so on. And therefore, these schools were autonomous almost. And you could actually, you may or may not have run into this, and I'm not sure where it cut out, but they used to give diplomas when you finished a school. And then when you finished all the schools, you got another diploma that said you were a full graduate. So you could be a graduate of the school, in theoretically, of Christian ethics at Southern Seminary, and not a graduate in the School of Church History.
So that was still present when you were going
to... No, they dropped... that was on the decline, but what you were talking about enlisting the students by courses is, in my judgment, a vestige of that. They hadn't quite gotten to the place that you were simply a student in the seminary, period. Though the students didn't feel this. The faculty had the sense of history. The students only remembered it from the day they enrolled, and therefore whatever was standard at the day they enrolled, they assume, was the historic position of the seminary. But that's probably irrelevant, but it just flicks through my mind.
That's an interesting point. Because I wondered, in about 1939 or 40, it discontinued in the catalog after that.
Well, you see, you were breaking down all along, even, I'm tempted to chase a rabbit, but the point is, Ellis Fuller was elected president, and in his job description, initiated by the trustees, not by him, and there's a controversy over that I'm answering. He was defined as the executive president of the seminary in a way no president had been president before. And the trustees made the blunder of not communicating this to the faculty, but depending on him to communicate it. So the faculty did not hear it from, he heard it from the trustees and thought what he was saying was just routine. But the faculty didn't hear the trustees. They heard him saying something that was brand new and cut across the grain of this history, you see. But the seminary had been moving in that direction of distinguishing between the president and the faculty, or administration and faculty, and a new distribution of duties between administration and faculty, which at the same time had the effect of coalescing the faculty, you see, into one unit, rather than the senior New Testament professor being the head of the School of New Testament Studies. And then it's almost the difference between a united affair and a confederation. And so the seminary really began as a kind of confederation of faculty members and schools, in which the concept of one professor being the primus inter pares, the first among equals, the chairman of the faculty, you see, meant simply he was the fellow who chaired the meeting of peers, and the gradual evolution across to the day when you would think in terms of administration with duties and faculty with duties, and you would not even distinguish the faculty would be one cohesive body over against administration, rather than the faculty being split up and having in its divided state the functions that dealt with instruction and administration. Well, I don't, that's probably not relevant to your interest, but just a little aside.
I think also, wasn't Dr. Fuller the first non-professor to become president of the seminary?
Yes. Well, not quite. You, even Mullins, you see, really came in to be president from the outside.
But what, hadn't he been a professor at Newton or
Newton? He had been a professor, but not here. But his identification as a professor, yes, I think if we go that route, it is correct to say that Fuller was the first man to be brought in who was not in any sense identified as a faculty member.
Which would, I think, also add to the tension.
Very definitely so, because it meant that you had a president who did not know how it felt to be a faculty member. And that's a very real distinction. The way it feels to be the administrator of a school is quite different from the way it feels to be a faculty member. And the perception of what has happened is quite different between these two postures. And it is, for that reason, really easier for a man to be a professor and acquire the second, the administrative perception, than it is to come the other way, because there is no vested interest in the administrator ever perceiving and the faculty perception of reality. I don't know that you picked this up. I gather from other things that I cannot document that Weatherspoon, who of course came on the faculty from Highland Church, really had some reason to believe that he might become the chairman of the faculty.
That was my next question. I knew that he was Dr. Sankey's favorite among favorites. And Dr. Sankey retiring, I wondered, were you at Broadway at this time? I wondered if he was considered succeed Dr. Sankey.
He not only considered to succeed Sankey, he was considered to succeed Fuller. And indeed, in a very real way, Weatherspoon was the chief faculty spokesman on at the close of the Fuller, at Fuller's death. Was a just open, hard-nosed advocate of Theron Rankin, of the Foreign Mission Board, to become president of Southern Seminary, a fact which I knew. And
you mentioned this, I think, a year or so ago, and you might understand. And to pursue that a little bit further, of course, Rankin...
Let me back up. You run on the fact that initially Dobbins and Weatherspoon were sort of the co-acting presidents of the seminary, and then I'm not sure how it evolved that Dobbins really became the primary one. I've never been able to dig that out, but by the time I really became involved with the seminary in the post-Fuller, after Fuller's death, by the time I really got involved, that had broken down or been altered in some way, and Dobbins was the acting president, and Weatherspoon had become the faculty spokesman. So Dobbins, and maybe this was why, Dobbins was more or less relating to the trustees as a neutral administrator, and Weatherspoon was relating to the trustees as the hard-nosed advocate of a specific candidate for the presidency.
I recall talking with Dr. Dobbins about this when he was here, and I'm trying to think, the impression that I got was that Dr. Weatherspoon really did not dig administration, and that Dr. Dobbins did, and his impression, they were in the position of co because they were senior faculty members. Mm-hmm. And then it just evolved to a place where, since Dr. Dobbins was doing the work and enjoying evidently doing it, that he moved on into the position.
But I think there's a little variation that I would give you as an impression that is both as a student and then coming here as president. I don't think it was that Weatherspoon couldn't do administration. as much as, and this is in